From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we speak with author and illustrator John Rocco about his new book, How We Got to the Moon, along with former NASA engineer Joanne Morgan.
I hope to inspire problem solvers, and that's why I created this book. I wanted people to look at, you know, here's an impossible problem. We're going to go to the moon, and we're going to do it in 9 years.
Then we hear from the young woman known as Little Miss Flint about her experience with the Flint water crisis.
So the water here is still not fixed, like it's not fixed at all. So people still have to go pick up bottled water, get filters. I mean, they're slowly changing the pipe, but they need to hurry up and fix it.
Plus, we look at some of the great events happening in Milwaukee this month. Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Award-winning author and illustrator John Rocco is perhaps best known for his cover art on the Percy Jackson and the Olympian series, along with other children's books. But about 20 years ago, Rocco worked at a company called Digital Domain doing special effects for a little film called Apollo 13, which he says sparked a deeper interest in the many complexities of how we get people into space. Today, Rocco has a new children's book called How We Got to the Moon. He wrote and meticulously illustrated each step of the space race and tells the stories of the 400,000 people behind this grand accomplishment, from geologists to seamstresses, welders, and engineers. One of those engineers featured in the book is Joanne Morgan, the only woman in the Launch Control Center when Apollo 11 lifted off. She had a career that spanned more than 45 years at NASA and is still involved in encouraging other women to get involved in STEM. Both Rocco and Morgan join me now, and Rocco starts by explaining what his book can give to young readers that's been missing in other accounts of the Apollo missions.
Well, I had looked at a lot of different books about the Apollo program for young people, and most of them tend to focus on the astronauts and their mission. And I didn't see much about everything that went on before that happened, what led to it, what was the buildup. And so for me, it was about the people on the ground who made the machines that actually supported this mission. And I wanted to structure it in a way where you got some of the history as to why we were actually going to the moon, but also you would slowly uncover the science behind it all. And if you break it down, everything we did, you know, can be boiled down to these really simple scientific ideas, whether it be Newton's laws or thermodynamics or orbital mechanics. And so they build upon each other.
Yeah, this book is kind of an art, physics, history, and science book all in one. And you mentioned you kind of go over some basic physics laws. There's photographs you recreate, drawings, blueprints, and so much more. And what's all the more impressive is that you illustrated everything from scratch. So why did you want to do that?
I think for me, the biggest reason was because as you go through all these documents and blueprints and everything that NASA has put out there in the world, it can be overwhelming. And especially when you put some of that stuff into a book, it loses a little bit of accessibility for our young readers, I think. Having it all drawn by one hand kind of creates a more accessible approach. And as I recreated some of these things in the book, I was able to really focus on the things that I needed to show to get the point across and remove all the extraneous stuff that just adds confusion.
As you mentioned, NASA has put out so much to the public of blueprints, photos, what was involved in the Apollo missions. So what was your research process like, and who did you get to speak with, and did you get to see any of these objects that you draw and recreate, like, up close and in person? Because I imagine there's just so many primary things to look at.
Yeah, it's interesting. I started off with as probably everyone does who writes about the space program, with everything that's available online, and then also in a myriad of books. I have an entire bookshelf dedicated to Apollo. But, you know, there's a lot of things that I didn't understand, and I knew if I couldn't understand them, there's no way I could, you know, present that information to a young reader and have them understand it. So I started reaching out to the Apollo engineers themselves. You know, with 400,000 people that worked on this program, you can find someone who is still around, who worked on this part or this, you know, was the systems engineer for this aspect of the rocket. And so it started with a guy that I met named Donald Rethke. And he brought me to his house and to the museum where he was a docent. And within like 15 minutes, I was holding an actual Apollo spacesuit, which I probably shouldn't have. But when he said, yeah, you can unzip it and check it out, I was on board. And within a few minutes of arriving at his house, he had the entire table filled with all kinds of everything from space toilets to helmets and gloves. And so I was able to inspect a lot of different things. I traveled around the country to lots of different museums. And I think by the time I started the second draft of the book, I had about 24 Apollo engineers, including Joanne Morgan, answering my questions about any particular aspect of it. And through that process, I got to hear their personal stories, which, you know, a lot of them I hadn't read anywhere. And I've read a lot about the program. So when you meet these individual people who are not necessarily the Gene Kranz or the Kurt Debus or the people that are higher up and more familiar, you get these stories that no one's heard before. And that was fascinating.
Yeah, I love learning about the things us lay people don't think about when it comes to launching people into space. You know, you show everyone from the well-known seamstresses to geologists, and you show that it's not all the white men in the control room that we see all the pictures of. And you mentioned Joanne Morgan, and she's here with us on the line. And Joanne, you were the instrumentation controller for Apollo 11 and the only woman in the Launch Control Center when that launched. And you had lived in Florida as a teenager where you could see rockets launch pretty frequently. But what was it that sparked your interest in pursuing engineering and being in NASA?
Well, I had a natural inclination for math and science as a high school student. But I always thought I'd probably be a piano teacher because I was very musical, too. And Explorer 1 was launched in 1958 in January, and the discovery of the Van Allen belt, and I got to see that launch. It was a night launch, not real visible because there was quite a few clouds that night, but still I got to see it. But I was most impressed by the discovery of the Van Allen belt and us understanding as a student, a senior in high school, that this new knowledge, nobody had ever known. Nobody on planet Earth had ever known this about our atmosphere. And what that meant to me was there is an incredible wealth of new knowledge that is going to come from these rockets going into space. And that door is opening, and I just wanted to get in on it. I thought this is going to change the world I live in. And as I reflect on it, my gosh, hasn't it in 50 years, 60 years? Because now we're so dependent on all of these things that are flying around the Earth in space, and understanding everything from navigation, communications, weather, Earth observing. I mean, we're very dependent on that new knowledge now that we're getting from space and all of the technology. So I was just a lucky kid in the right place at the right time with an inclination and had enjoyed math and science as a student. So I thought I'm going to become an engineer. I was only 17, and I hope if there are girls that are going to get a chance to read this book, that they really do some serious thinking about the fact that we need women in engineering. And I was just thrilled to be that lucky woman who was sitting in launch control and doing my job. I'd been there for 10 years, and that was my first launch to actually sit in the firing room at liftoff. I'd worked on launches, but I was excused a few hours before, and then a more senior person would take the position for the actual liftoff. But they asked me to be there, and I was just totally thrilled to death to be a part of making history.
Yeah, it's such an incredible moment. And your role on that day was instrumentation controller in the launch room for Apollo 11 liftoff. So can you explain what exactly that involves?
Well, the instrumentation controller was looking at a breadth of systems, telemetry, tracking, data systems, the displays that were available coming from the computer that was reducing the guidance data from the vehicle as we were getting ready for liftoff, and then during the early phase of the mission while the engines were running, so that first 10 minutes after liftoff. And so it was a case of looking for and instrumentation on the ground too, including weather instrumentation. So it was a broad-based kind of role, but it was about communicating to the test supervisors and the top management team of the launch team if there were problems and how those problems were being worked and what our options were. Luckily, we had a wonderful countdown. I mean, we had almost a problem-free terminal countdown. So there was only one problem, a hydrogen leak, and that got worked. And the instrumentation that were detecting the leaks, everything was, you know, ticky-boo, as we would say. So it was a role of pretty broad-based systems knowledge that I had to have that I had acquired over a 10-year period of working there.
One of the things that you shared with me, Joanne, which I always come back to, is the fact that the reason you were placed in that chair was because you were the best communicator.
Yeah, my director, Carl Spindler, called me in to tell me that I was going to be there for liftoff. He said, you have such a good knowledge and your awareness of where a problem is and how it's being worked and what our options are. You communicate that so rapidly and so clearly. You're our best communicator, Joanne. So, and that went to even my writing in the logbook. He could read my writing, and I had good English and good punctuation, and, you know, I was a good student in school. So and some engineers weren't so great at doing, writing in the logbook, and our logs would go off those, everything was a lot of paper then, you know, we didn't have the computer technology that we depend on today. So you hand wrote things, and then they got typed up, and those records were kept, and they were carbon copies back then. So a little thing like a good solid skill of writing and speaking where people could understand you were important.
Most definitely. And John recreated the picture of you in the Launch Control Center. What do you think about when you look at that shot, and what would you like people to keep in mind now, knowing what you know, and of course it's your personal experience? What do you want people to see looking at a photo of the only woman in the room?
Well, that sometimes, because you're the only person, in my case being a female and all the others were men, is that we are all able to do everything. Men, women, no matter what race, that the potential is in each human being. And I think that each human being should aspire to be as great as they can at what they love doing. In my case, I had a passion for knowledge. I love learning new things. And I got attracted to the launch industry because of that. And it's rewarded me. I never had a dull day at work. I learned something every day. And so I just encourage people to take away from me is to find that something you have a passion for and explore, and it will make you great in your own way. Each of us is able to do that.
One of the many things I learned from this book is about Randy Lovelace's Women in Space program that ran from 1960 to 1962, but unfortunately women wouldn't be accepted into the astronaut program for another 16 years. And Joanne, your career at NASA spanned over 45 years and includes top positions such as First Woman Division Chief, the First Woman Senior Executive at the Kennedy Space Center, the First Woman Associate Director for KSC. And I can't imagine this was easy or that all rooms were receptive and welcoming to having a woman in their ranks leading them. So can you touch upon some of your experiences working up through the ranks? And one thing that stuck out to me on a NASA article is that, you know, you don't ask engineers to make you coffee.
Oh, yeah, that was my very first supervisor, Jim White. I mean, I hit the gold standard of supervisors. He insisted on an environment of mutual respect. I was there as an engineer trainee. I aspired to be an engineer, but I was going to be a young girl. I was only 17. That was a summer job. And so when he had his staff meeting and explained to all of those men, there was going to be a woman who was going to be working here. And the first thing somebody asked, oh, can we get her to make coffee? And he said, no, she's not the coffee girl. She is a student trainee engineer. She's to be treated just like you would treat any young man who comes in here who's a college student.
You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski, and I'm speaking with author and illustrator John Rocco and former NASA engineer Joanne Morgan. Since you started going from spending 10 years at NASA before you even had a first launch to be included in the room to making executive decisions and leading, you know, do you think when you retired and left NASA, do you think that they are doing enough yet to inspire and promote STEM programs to bring in a more diverse workforce, to bring in more women and people of other races and backgrounds?
Well, I certainly think so when I look at Kennedy Space Center, because last summer, in fact, John, you were there at the Apollo 11 luncheon to honor the women of Apollo 11. The director, Bob Cabana, who was an astronaut and is still the director of the Kennedy Space Center, he was telling that something over 40% of his direct report senior executives now are women. And his associate director, a job I once had held, is an African-American young man who actually had worked for me. I mentored him. So the work they're doing for STEM is just amazing. But, and also the NASA Alumni League, which I'm on their National Board of Directors, and they are very active in STEM activities. I think NASA probably overall reflects what I see at Kennedy Space Center. I don't know the exact data today, but I'm much more concerned now about our universities graduating enough women engineers and minority engineers, because, you know, we need that breadth involved in decision making. I think when you look at stuff like the Boeing airplane issues with the MAX and the auto industry, when the things don't work like airbags, that if women were involved in decision making in those organizations, that you wouldn't see some of that happening. So I'm just very, very much hopeful and wishing that universities would graduate a lot more women engineers and get them out there into the workforce. And companies needed to be hiring them. You know, there's less than 15% of the working engineers in this country are women. That's a terrible statistic. I mean, it was like less than 2% when I started out as a young NASA engineer. It's a tough industry for women these days. And as one of the STEM factors, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, engineering is behind as far as opportunities exist for women. But somehow or another, they're not, even though a lot of universities graduate women engineers, they're not necessarily being embraced in the workplace. you know, like I was lucky enough to have the positive experience that, and was rewarded for it with promotion, but it's not that great in a lot of places today.
And it should be said, when Joanne invited me down to that luncheon down in Florida, it was no surprise that many of the women in the room got up to speak about how Joanne mentored them in their careers. She graciously deflects praise, but it was sort of awe-inspiring to see.
Well, and what do you both hope this book can do for young readers, young girls exploring its pages and learn more about the stories such as Joanne's and all of these other people who helped us get into space and helped us land on the moon?
Well, you know, I think that seeing faces that are like your own in a book sort of opens up that possibility, I think, for young readers. It was my intention to show people of color and the different sexes that were involved in doing this huge project. I hope to inspire problem solvers. And that's why I created this book. I wanted people to look at, you know, here's an impossible problem. We're going to go to the moon and we're going to do it in 9 years. It's this incredibly impossible problem. And all of these people got together and they worked together and they solved each little, you know, problem at a time, and they strung all those solutions together to figure out how to put a human being on another planet, which, you know, when we look back at that many years from now, it's going to be a big moment in history. And there were a lot of different interesting people involved, and so, you know, my hope is that kids will read this book and see all different possibilities for themselves in working on future problems.
And Joanne, what do you hope that young readers think about and learn about when they read about some of the work that you and many of your other colleagues were involved in the Apollo missions?
Well, one thing that I like about the book is the simplicity of the way John has broken it down, so that almost any one little thing is simply explained where you can understand it. I mean, it's almost overwhelming to think about a project like going to the moon. It's so complex, and here these hundreds of thousands of people are involved. It's like, it's so overwhelming, but it actually is simple because it has to be broken down into these very simple little pieces, and then they're all put together like a giant, giant, giant puzzle, and then there's this beautiful picture, and you're landing on the moon. So if you for a child, a student, even a teacher looking at this, you can explain these pieces along the way. An individual, a youngster, a boy or a girl, can say, but I can be one of those pieces. I can know about a propulsion system, or I can know about a radar system, or, you know, I can be a part of this puzzle and be a part of history. And in a way, that's what inspired me as a young person. I didn't know what role I would play when I decided to become an engineer, but I wanted to be that one piece of that puzzle. And that can be anybody. Anybody can do this. And I hope it inspires some people to want to do it, because there are big, big, big projects ahead of us. I mean, this is certainly the biggest of my lifetime, and I think maybe the most important engineering accomplishment of the last 1,000 years, and maybe the next 1,000, who knows? I mean, I'm hoping I'm 80 years old. I hope I'll get to see us land on Mars and maybe a woman land on the moon, but maybe I won't get to see it. But, you know, these young people, they not only will see it, they can do it. They can choose to do it. And that's what I hope, is that some of them choose to do something great with their lives.
John Rocco is an award-winning author and illustrator whose latest book is called How We Got to the Moon: The People, Technology, and Daring Feats of Science Behind Humanity's Greatest Adventure. He was joined by former NASA engineer Joanne Morgan. Both Rocco and Morgan, along with Anne Montgomery, the Apollo lead crew systems engineer, will hold a virtual event for Boswell Books this Friday evening. There's so much more to our conversation with John Rocco and Joanne Morgan, and you can find the extended interview at WUWM.com. Coming up, we hear from a young activist who caught the attention of former President Barack Obama. This is Like Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. In the spring of 2016, residents of Flint, Michigan were experiencing one of the country's most devastating water crises. Flint native Mari Kopany decided to do something about it. She wrote a letter to then-President Barack Obama, and the response she got far exceeded her expectations. Mari was just 8 years old at the time. Now, at 13, she's launched into a life of activism. This weekend, Mari will be the keynote speaker at Alverno College's Girls Summit to recognize International Day of the Girl. The goal is to nurture leadership skills and encourage girls to become civically engaged. WUWM's Susan Bentz spoke with Mari Kopany earlier this week via Zoom. Mari began by describing what led her to writing to President Obama more than 4 years ago.
So during that time, the water crisis was happening, like you mentioned, and it was still really bad. So basically what was going on was that people were getting really bad rashes, the water stinked, it was messing up with like the heads and stuff like that. It was making people sick, they were dying. We could not drink the water at all. We couldn't even bathe in it. Like, we couldn't even do the stuff that we normally do with the water because it turned out to be bad.
How did this idea of writing to the president come to you? Did your mom say, hey, Mari, write a letter, or you were inspired? What happened?
Okay, so basically, since the water crisis was, like, really bad at the time, and I was like, since I wanted to see for the congressional hearings, how about I write to, you know, Mr. Obama to see, you know, if he'll respond back to me? Because, you know, people write to people all the time. I thought that he was going to respond. So that was just going through my mind. I was like, wait, but I have to tell him about the water crisis to see what he can do to help. So that's what I did.
So, Mari, did anyone in your family get sick, or any of your friends or relatives actually get sick during that time?
My little sister. I won't say she was, like, sick, but she had, like, this really, really, really bad rash to the point where she had to be put in this special ointment was it plastic wrap? Yeah, it was plastic wrap. She had to be covered in plastic wrap because that's how bad the rash was.
And here you were, an 8-year-old, and you wrote this letter. You mailed it off, and how long was it before you heard back?
I think it was 2 months. Okay, yeah, it was 2 months before he responded.
And did he say, I'll come and see you? I'll come and visit Flint?
My mom had got a call from a secret number, and she was like, oh, what's this? It was the White House. And basically, they were like, President Obama not only wants to write you back, but he wants to meet you. Mom was like, this is fake, like, you're playing. They started reading off the letter, and the thing is that she didn't post out the letter publicly, so how would they be able to read it? So she was like, oh, so this is legit. And I didn't know at the time, like, I had no idea that I was actually gonna, you know, I didn't know that he was gonna respond to me or, you know, like, just meet me, since I was in third grade at the time. So, like, you know, I was just minding my business, you know, being casual. And then that happened.
Now you're so much older, but how different is it in Flint today? How is the water much better? Do lots of people have, instead of having lead service lines that, you know, bring the water into your homes, there those have been changed out? Is it much, much better, or is it slowly getting better?
So the water here is still not fixed. Like, it's not fixed at all. So people still have to go pick up bottled water and get filters. I mean, they're slowly changing the pipes, but I think they delayed it because, you know, COVID and stuff like that. But they need to hurry up and fix it. But I wouldn't rush them though, because, you know, COVID and stuff like that.
So you've taken on a lot of projects, raising money for kids in Flint for things like backpacks filled with school supplies. You've helped distribute over 1 million bottles of bottled water, right? You're involved in anti-bullying issues, and you're also encouraging young people older than you, but old enough to vote when they reach that voting age. So where does your inspiration come from to do all of these things?
Look, I just want to fix the world. So these ideas come up from inside my mind and my mind only, with a little bit of help from my mom and a little bit of help from my team, Team Mari, but most of it, it just comes from my mind because I really want to fix the world and make the world a better place.
Tell me about Team Mari.
Basically just all my supporters are pretty much all my followers on Twitter and Instagram, some of my friends, but they're just my supporters. I just call them Team Mari because they help me with stuff. And I wouldn't be able to pull off giant events and stuff if it wasn't for Team Mari.
Absolutely. Everybody needs a team, right?
Yep.
So you mentioned your mom. Who is the person or who are the people who inspire you, who give you that drive to make things better in the world?
The kids in Flint, they inspire me so much because there's not a lot of people here. Since I live in like Flint, like I don't live in like one of the upscale areas. Like it's decent, like it's not rich and it's not poor. It's literally just decent. But anyways, since I live inside Flint, there's not a lot of, you know, families that can afford nice stuff like other kids got. So basically, you know, I do stuff for the kids because I want to make the kids happy because I don't want to see any kid left out of anything. I want to make sure they feel involved and I want to make sure they feel loved.
I'm guessing you speak a lot. You're going to be keynoting for Alverna University's Wisconsin Girls Summit. It also falls on International Day of the Girl. So what are you going to be sharing with those attendees who tune in?
So basically, I'm just going to be talking about, you know, girls and how they can just change the world, basically. Just going to be an inspirational speech. Yeah.
So when you are inspiring, but when you think of ways to inspire people, what do you tell them? Stories? Do you tell them what your life is like in Flint or what it's been like meeting different people and how every step brings some change or can bring some change?
I tell them about my story and how they can just help and change the world.
Do people still call you Little Miss Flint even though you're not so little?
Yeah, people still call me that. I don't really mind. Don't but, you? Like, I'm just not that little anymore. I'm 13 already.
Exactly.
But I really don't mind.
Exactly. So then I'm not going to call you Little Miss Flint. I don't think I would anyway. You're a big personality. You're a big person. It's amazing that you have the drive and vision and determination to change the world. So when you say changing the world, what are some of the things that need to change?
Some of the things I need to change is that the world is, okay, so Black Lives Matter, period. It's not a question. We just need to fix that because, you know, Black lives do matter. We need to fix the racist people inside the world. We don't need any racists inside the world because they're only just making it, you know, worse. And, like, we don't need that. We need to change, you know. We need to fix the water crisis. It's not just Flint that has a water crisis. It's America that has a water crisis. But nobody talks about it because people think that it's not a common deal there. We need to get kids out of cages. That's one thing. We need to get them out of cages. They deserve to be with their families. There's just a lot of stuff we need to fix out the world. Like, because the world has an issue right now. Like, the world always has issues. But it's really bad in 2020 because more people are just making it bad. But yeah, we need to fix that.
You're setting a high bar for yourself. One day, do you plan to be president?
Yes, I do. In 2044.
And how do you, now at this age, I know you said school is a little boring. It's extra boring because it's virtual. But how do you balance school and being a teenager, along with your passion to give young people a voice? All of that. How do you balance all that?
It's not really hard. I mean, I'm still a normal kid. I do normal kid stuff. Like, I skateboard, I draw, I eat, I sleep. I do normal kid stuff. But I also balance that with, you know, my activism and my posting and stuff like that. It's just balance in between. Like, it's like one of those thingies. We have the activism side and the normal kid side. Then we have me in the middle.
Very cool. So there'll be a lot of different people who listen to this, to what you had to say today, maybe for the first time, maybe they haven't heard of Mari, the Flint girl. What do you want people to think about? What message do you want to leave them with as we end our conversation?
So the message I want to get there is that if you want to start activism, you can start activism. You could change the world. I know you have a voice, so just use that voice, because you can't start saying your opinions and stuff like that if you don't use your voice. That's what I have to learn. And look, here I am right now, speaking to you right now, because I have a voice, so you want to use that voice. And I'm sure you can change the world if you put your mind to it. And don't forget to vote for me for president in 2044!
13-year-old Flint, Michigan native Mari Kopany spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Benz. Kopany will be the keynote speaker at Alverno College's State of Wisconsin Girls Summit this Saturday. We'll take one more break, then hear about some of the events happening here in Milwaukee this month. Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Every month, Adam Carr from the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service talks about some of the many community events happening in the city in a segment aptly called Five Things to Do in Milwaukee. Since the coronavirus pandemic began, this list has included a wide array of things, from virtual museum exhibits to Zoom events, and now some socially distanced, in-person things to experience. Carr joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about some of the exciting events happening this month.
It's an interesting month, of course. Wisconsin has had record high rates of COVID-19, at least for our state. And so a lot of the things that had opened up are kind of closing down once again. We're also getting into a time of year where there's usually a lot of community events, and yet we're seeing fewer that are really willing to be in person.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's kind of that new normal, all the different new normals we've been navigating. A lot of organizations have called audibles and brought their events virtual. They've gone physical, then unphysical. And we have an interesting assortment for October 2020.
For sure. So let's get into this list. The first event is at a place that I think a lot of our listeners are going to be familiar with, but it's a new exhibit.
Absolutely. So Alice's Garden is a phenomenal community space. It's a 2.2-acre community farm in the heart of Milwaukee's north side. They've done events with social distancing, health and safety in mind throughout the summer and now fall season. And they have an event, an outdoor art exhibit. So they, you know, as many ways as people have used Alice's Garden, this is a brand new way of using it. It's named See Me Because Art Start Portrait Project Volume 8. From my understanding, this was actually at one point slated to be in Central Park in New York, but because of the pandemic, that plan needed to be shifted. And it's exciting that it will be right here in Milwaukee. The exhibition is showing different portraits, multimedia platforms to show Milwaukee's boys and young men of color, to present them really in the way they want to be seen, exploring the complexity of their identities and their own narratives. And I saw a preview just on Venus Williams's phone yesterday. They're building new frames to put this exhibit. So it's going to be all outdoors. People can view it in a very socially distanced way. You can check more out about that event, about how to see these portraits. the name of the event is See Me Because Art Start Portrait Project. So if you look that up, they're going to be viewing times between October 15th and November 7th at Alice's Garden. So yeah, and the folks involved in making it, there's some really great Milwaukee-based artists who are part of this exhibit.
I was about to say, so who is making these portraits? Is it the young men who are being featured in them, or are they other artists who have partnered with these young men?
So yes to that. From my understanding, really the young men got to be sort of artistic directors and working with a variety of different artists to shape how they would be portrayed. So from my understanding, the young men had a direct involvement in how those portraits came to be. And then they collaborated with talented artists to render their reality. So,
all right. Well, those will be really interesting to see. This next event, I think it's what's on all of our minds to some extent, all of the time, at least those of us who work in the news. But it's a specific event here in Milwaukee. Tell us a bit about this.
So, yes, October of a year in which there's a presidential election, the streets, the telephone lines, the text message inboxes normally would be on fire with folks, especially in Wisconsin and in Milwaukee, with get out the vote efforts, with people doing voter engagement. And obviously the pandemic has thrown a massive monkey wrench in that. And I've seen all kinds of different ways in which folks working locally have gotten creative in this moment too. The other mandate is helping people figure out how to vote, where it's not quite as straightforward as it normally would be. So Walnut Way Community Conservation Corporation, a beautiful community institution in Milwaukee, they do a lot of work within their neighborhood around health and community gardening and building economic wealth with people. They've partnered with the Wisconsin Conservation Voices to do a walkthrough voter registration at their headquarters right at 1615 17th Street, so right off the corner of North and 17th. So Walnut Way is using their beautiful Walnut Way home, which has kind of become iconic in the city. This incredible home that's next to it is an orchard where they grow peaches. Right in that space, they're calling it easy, fun, and safe. They're thinking a lot about social distancing and making sure anyone who walks in, their staff will be wearing full PPE for folks to register to vote, and obviously then pick up information on the different ways you can do that. So I think, you know, that's one of the things I've seen heartened by is obviously this moment and all the challenges, the choppy waters people are navigating with the pandemic. Seeing how folks are getting creative and really continuing their work no matter what, and in this case, helping people register to vote.
Yeah, especially important in a year where some things have changed with voting and where there's a very important election.
Absolutely.
So this next event, it's actually something that we've talked about, the Black Lens series within the Milwaukee Film Festival. But of course, like everything this year, like voter registration, like art exhibits that were intended to be in Central Park, things have changed for the film festival. Things will not be in person in the same way that they were before. What is this series going to look like this year?
So the Milwaukee Film Festival is going virtual this year. So it's from October 15th to the 29th. And the film festival, they're screening nearly 200 films. So, and sometimes, you know, the pandemic has allowed opportunities to experiment where folks are expanding what they're doing. So in these 200 films that the film festival screening, you know, they're selling tickets to virtual screenings. They're also doing different events and talkbacks. And actually, in typical film festival fashion, they kind of announce them all right up into the run-up to the film festival. So we're not even sure yet entirely all that they're doing, though some of that stuff is yet to be announced. I will say I have a great partner. My wife is a film festival fanatic, and I ride on her coattails. She looks through every single film. You know, she makes all of her notes and makes her plans to go see everything. And I find the Black Lens program within the Milwaukee Film Festival always to be a phenomenal curator. So Gerard and Dante, who run Black Lens, those guys are geniuses across multiple different capacities, but they are incredible curators anytime Black Lens is doing something, I know they're going to be to do it right. So if you want to look through all of the 200 films and choose ones for yourself, that's great. You can also, there's a very handy dandy filter you can use, the Black Lens filter, that shows about 21 films. So that narrows down the realm of possibility for all those films. And within their films, that's what's the beauty of the film festival every year. I'm looking at a film named Growing Up Milwaukee. It's a film I hadn't heard of, following the lives of three young Black men growing up in Milwaukee. Another film that always something the film festival is good for is takes you somewhere else and immerses you in a different world. It's called Dark City Beneath the Beat, another film part of Black Lens that's about the club scene in Baltimore. And I'm really excited to look at that. So no matter what your interests are, the film festival always has something that matches it. But I think specifically the Black Lens film series, they are always sterling in their recommendations.
One of the things that we've talked about with our team over here at Lake Effect is that unlike typical years where there would be, you know, a couple showings usually, but specific times when you're able to view the films, because things are going to be virtual, that's all out the window. That's all changed. What is that going to look like this year?
It looks like essentially you can buy virtual tickets and then you can watch, you know, obviously there'll be events that have specific times, but you'll be able to watch when you please. So in some ways it's maybe, from my understanding, I could be getting this wrong, but there's a way in which it's maybe more flexible than ever as well. So less FOMO this year, fear of missing out.
This year you can see all of it.
Maybe. I mean, I think literally you might not be able to, just because there's so many films. But yeah, it's going to be binge watching without standing in lines.
So this next event, also, you do not have to stand in a line. And it's something that actually comes from the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service.
Absolutely. So I work behind the scenes at Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, as you know. And one of the great privileges and honors I have of working there is I work with a lot of our op-ed and personal essay submissions in our Community Voices section. And this year, we've been celebrating Heritage and History Months throughout the year. We happen to be right now during Hispanic Heritage Month, which runs from September 15th to October 15th. And we've had great submissions to different Heritage and History Months throughout the year of 2020. But this month, we've just had an embarrassment of riches, just wonderful, thoughtful, in-depth, personal, vulnerable pieces that folks have written throughout the month. Sergio Gonzalez, he's a history professor that focuses on Latinx history in Milwaukee and Wisconsin. I asked him if he would write, and he said, you know, I kind of have a bone to pick with Hispanic Heritage Month. And I said, great, that's the perfect way to lead off the month. And making sure that we look deeper than just the surface level and go beyond that. And, you know, he looks back to the first Mexican workers arriving in Milwaukee 100 years ago in his piece, which is beautiful. Also got great pieces from a friend of mine, Juan Miguel Martinez, about his journey to becoming a brown beret. Rinaldo Hernandez, the great artist, his daughters, Rosalia and Marisa, wrote a reflection on his 50-year art legacy in the city. Eloisa Gomez wrote about writing the book Somos Latinas and collecting oral histories of Latina activists around Wisconsin. And we had a young activist named Alejandra Gonzalez write about her experience being a DACA recipient and her family finding Milwaukee. And so just point is, MilwaukeeNNS.org, we've had this great series of personal essays that I think explore the experience with the prompt of Hispanic Heritage Month of all these different ways of how Latinx people live and have lived in Milwaukee.
Nice. Now, of course, October is not only Hispanic Heritage Month, it's also the time of year when many of us would be celebrating Halloween. Of course, we know that trick-or-treating in the city of Milwaukee will not be happening this year in light of the pandemic. There are a number of events that have also been canceled as a result of the pandemic that involve Halloween. It's also not just Halloween during October. We also have Day of the Dead. And you have some events you'd like to highlight to celebrate this.
Absolutely. Day of the Dead, which obviously falls during the same time of the year as Halloween, is a different celebration, a totally different celebration that's rooted in actually multiple cultures, but is very big in the Spanish-speaking world, and specifically some of the roots for how it's celebrated in Milwaukee is connected to Mexican culture. It's a time of year that I think especially when we kind of think of the whole parade of holidays that run through the year, it's one that's really reflective. It's about not just acknowledging death, but celebrating those who have passed. It's a time of family, and it's a time of reflection. And there was a Day of the Dead parade that's gone for a long time in Milwaukee that did cease, but has kind of opened a space for a lot of different celebrations. Walker's Point Center for the Arts, they've done this long-standing celebration of the Day of the Dead for this will be their 28th year. So they do an exhibit, and how it looks this year, I'm not actually entirely sure. So some folks are still waiting to announce their plans. Latino Arts has actually announced their whole slate of activities. Many of them, the virtual, they're doing some very limited events where you can be in person, where they're really very small audiences that get to go into the gallery. They are doing their annual display of ofrendas, which are the altars that people create to honor past loved ones. So Latino Arts Inc., which is inside of UCC, is doing work in addition to Walker's Point Center for the Arts. Last year, Zocalo, the food truck park, did a great celebration. Even small things like Lopez Bakery is already, even though the official Day of the Dead's not till the end of the month, Lopez Bakery is making bakery. So there's little ways in which, even in a time of pandemic, it's out there, and there are ways in which people can celebrate their loved ones during Day of Dead celebrations, virtual, some in person. So if anything, too, I might be a little vague right now. Just keep your eyes open, because a lot of the events haven't yet been announced. That's been kind of part of the new normal. But I know that there are a number of different organizations, institutions that will show up to do Day of the Dead programming.
For sure. It'll be interesting to see how things shape up as kind of the contours of the pandemic become more clear getting toward the end of the month. Well, Adam Carr, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing these events.
Yeah, hang in there, and I'll see you in November.
Adam Carr is the Deputy Editor for Community Engagement at the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. You can find more of our conversations with them about Milwaukee's Central City neighborhoods at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.